BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
BCFM 93.2, broadcasting live from the Cascade Steps at the Bristol Harbour Festival, Saturday 31st July and Sunday 1st August.
Bristol Community FM 93.2, your voice, your choice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and my guest to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Dr. Lee Salter, who's Journalism Programme Leader at the University of the West of England. Well, we normally have an MP or councillor on, but as the politicians take a break with their summer recess in Westminster and here at Bristol Council House too, so we'll be taking a break from them. After the 6 o'clock news, well, it's a recession, and with an expected upsurge in crime, unemployment increases and benefits are cut, we ask, is Britain getting it right when the courts decide to lock someone up? We're joined by Deputy Director of the Howard League for Penal Reform, Andrew Nielsen, and joining us too is freelance journalist Phil Chamberlain, who's something of an expert on prison labour schemes, which pay rather less than the minimum wage, as little as £4 a week. That's in the second hour. Well, on to this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. Highs of 20 degrees Celsius this weekend, fairly dry with some sunny spells. A small amount of rain on Sunday afternoon. Highs next week, around about 20 degrees Celsius again. A fair amount of sun this week, especially on some mornings. So get out early if you want some sun. Showers, especially on Tuesday evening. Next weekend, that's the 7th and 8th of August, highs of 20 degrees Celsius again, staying pretty much the same temperature. Fairly dry with some sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now, and with me is Lee Salter. Hello, Lee, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello there.
Now, tell me, Lee, you're a head of the journalism programme at University of the West of England. What's your background?
My background's varied. It's in academia mainly. I mean, I've worked for a short period for Una King when I finished university.
So she was a Labour MP?
She was the Labour MP for Bethnal Green and Bow, which was won thereafter by George Galloway, which was very interesting. So I finished university in 97 when the Blair government got elected. I'd grown up under, you know, Thatcherism, and was for a couple of years very excited about the prospect of a Labour government. And, you know, went to work in the constituency office, which was, you know, it was great, very rewarding.
So were you one of these people who was photographed popping champagne corks when Tony Blair was elected in 1997?
No champagne, unfortunately, no. I wasn't that close.
But anyhow, over at the University of West of England now, how many journalism students do you have there?
We have around 250 in all 3 years, and then another 25 master's students at the university.
But the big question has to be, you know, are there jobs for your graduates when they finish?
This is the big fight that we're having at the moment with the kind of expectations of universities given government policies about things like employability and what have you. Personally, I argue that the news industry has failed journalism by failing to take up new technologies and early enough stage, such as the internet, feeling threatened by them and trying to stop them rather than embracing them and trying to do things with them. And if you look at many of the programs around the country for journalism, they try to introduce kind of quite vocational, industry-controlled modes of doing journalism, of what constitutes professional journalism. What we're trying to do is to try and explore new ways of doing journalism, new ways of applying journalistic skills. So we're not really looking at the kind of putting journalism graduates into the local newspaper. There's, you know, been massive cuts there, massive cuts at ITV West. What we're trying to do is get them to do it themselves, to come up with new projects, such as, you know, what you're doing here, for example.
Now, how do you see the profession at the moment here in Britain? Because you just mentioned that there've been quite a lot of cuts in the local newspaper. Is that the same pretty much broadly across the country as we're going into a recession?
Well, it's this, I think not just in journalism, across the board, you know, the first instinctive response of people who are out to make money is to cut when they're faced with these sorts of issues. It's quite worrying to see a concerted response to the economic crisis as cut, cut, cut. As far as journalism's concerned, it's worrying. I mean, you look at the, you know, Richard Desmond, the pornographer and Daily Express owner, has just bought Channel 5, and the first thing he's going to do is cut and dumb down and get rid of, you know, serious content and just produce cheap rubbish for the television waves. And, you know, Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch owns The Sun and Sky, or most of Sky. He's trying to buy the whole of Sky at the moment. And you're seeing this process of consolidation and cuts. And frankly, I'm worried about the future.
Because there's a bit of a battle going on there, isn't there? When media bosses like Rupert Murdoch want to have actually more and more of a spread right across, you know, different magazines, book publishing, newspapers like, you know, high-end newspapers like The Times, the low-end, they want to be absolutely everywhere. And yet the regulations that have been in there for years really prevent this. They're saying that cross-media ownership should be minimised. So who's going to win that fight? Because the government are likely to do deals with people like Rupert Murdoch if they want to get elected, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, they did deals with Tony Blair. You know, they did deals with the Conservatives this time. I think that when you get so few media companies owning so much of what we consume, when we as consumers believe these to be different news organisations, you know, you might buy The Sun as opposed to The Times and think these are separate things, think you have consumer choice. You might go home and watch Sky Television and think you're viewing something else. You're not. All three of those things are owned by one man who has access through his media to something like 2/3 of the world's population. And he is very, very, very controlling over his media products and what they say and how they say it. Every single one of his newspapers, I think around 275 newspapers, national newspapers around the world, had the same editorial line on Iraq, which was to invade Iraq. And, you know, if one person has that much power, I think we should all be worried.
Well, we're just hearing today from John Prescott that he was saying that he had serious doubts about the intelligence in the run-up to the Iraq war. So you do wonder if all the newspapers are saying that it's actually probably a positive thing to invade Iraq at the time, and people in the cabinet almost seem to be kind of sidelined by that.
I would have thought it's a similar thing with journalists and editors. I would have thought, you know, Rupert Murdoch's decision was made and imposed on the people who work for him, and they may have wanted to be a bit more critical themselves, the actual people who work in the news organisations. But at the end of the day, when the final copy comes out, when the headline and front pages come out, you know, that's got to be in line with what the owner's thinking. And I think that when, you know, if it was maybe 50% of his newspapers that had opposed the war and 50% that had supported it, okay, but it wasn't. It was every single one of his publications and news outlets supported the invasion.
Now, what about the Bristol University? Do they actually run any sort of competing courses to you? Do you sort of vie with Bristol University for journalism students?
Not at the moment, no. Not at the moment.
Okay. Anyway, we're also joined by Martin Summers, our old Labour Oxford economist. Martin, can you just tell us about this guy, Ejup Ganic? Because I know you were over in Bosnia, and we just heard this week that he is not going to be extradited to The Hague to face war crimes. Do you know much about this guy? Who was he?
Well, you've sprung this on me, so I haven't actually researched this at all.
Okay.
I mean,
but I know you were actually
over there. Ganic was a Bosnian Muslim. Am I correct in that?
Yeah.
And he's not going to be extradited because, you know, presumably there has been some mechanism presuming that he's not going to be convicted, or there's not sufficient evidence against him. I really don't know enough about his case to make a strong statement. What I would say, having worked in Bosnia during the war, is that all sides were not equal in the bad things they were doing. There was clearly a hierarchy of evil, with the Serbs at the top, the Croats in the middle, and the Bosnians at the bottom. But nobody was innocent in that situation. Everybody was manipulating the situation, and a lot of bad things done by all sides.
Do you think Yugoslavia was just sort of waiting to fall apart after the death of Tito? And, you know, was there bound to be some kind of civil war there?
Well, because listen, I mean, I've written a book in which I cover a lot of the issues leading to the Yugoslav war, but the collapse of the neoliberal reform in Eastern Europe. I mean, a lot a lot of people found it hard to explain why Yugoslavia, which had been the most liberal of the communist countries, with the most exposed economy to the international economy, they started running up international debts in the 70s, for example. Why did their economy disintegrate first, leading to this massive civil war? And that's because the reform of the economy, of the communist economies, was massively mishandled. That's the minimum that one would say. I spoke to an ex-Bulgarian foreign minister in Sofia, and he was firmly of the opinion that the whole thing had been engineered by outside powers in order to, you know, basically make geopolitical, and he meant basically the Americans and the West, to make, you know, they were playing geopolitical games with Yugoslavia. And Kosovo today, which is just recognised the independence of, has become the main transit route, for example, for drug smuggling into the European Union. And it's basically a gangster state run by the Kosovo Liberation Army, who are in alliance with the Western intelligence services, but also basically a criminal organisation. So a lot of people inside Yugoslavia, I mean, obviously, if you talk to anybody inside former Yugoslavia, you're going to get a different story, because there weren't just three sides in Bosnia, for example. There were factions within each faction. It was incredible. The closer you got to it, the more complicated it was, but none of it was particularly pleasant.
Okay, now we're going to start off by having a look at with our news review, having a look at some of David Cameron's statements. I've chosen an article from something called Arab News here, and it says UK Prime Minister David Cameron is in India at the invitation of Manmohan Singh, his Indian counterpart. With him is the largest delegation of British officials ever to visit the country: ministers, politicians, businessmen, scientists, academics, and others. Because Cameron wants to create a new special relationship between the two countries, which is as much as economic and political. But he has said all the wrong things to make it happen. So in Bangalore on Wednesday, he accused Pakistan of exporting terrorism to India and Afghanistan, and it was intolerable that it should be allowed to look both ways. So what do you think's behind this? It does seem that, Lee, let's start with you, that David Cameron is really sort of throwing his weight in with the Indians in actually what is quite a fragile relationship between India and Pakistan, and also quite possibly rather annoying many Pakistani-origin British residents.
I think it's politically inept to make that statement in India. I think among in intelligence circles for a long time, certainly when the decision was being made to invade Iraq, there were some concerns that, you know, well, obviously Iraq had nothing to do with September the 11th, but there were, you know, verbal concerns that actually it's not even Afghanistan, it's the border areas with Pakistan that are the problem that need to be dealt with and what have you. So there, you know, there have been in intelligence circles these discussions going on for a long time. But to make a statement like that in India, where of course Indian groups are fighting over Kashmir against Pakistani groups, Kashmiri groups and what have you, I think it's a political faux pas beyond belief.
But do you think he's maybe just simply referring to things like this Mumbai attack, which many people have been pinning on the Pakistan, you know, Pakistan elements?
I mean, maybe. I think it's a very complicated area, because what we also have to consider is the US administration's realignment of its so-called war on terror, or that's inherited off George Bush, toward Afghanistan and away from Iraq. And so one wonders there how much of this has to do with talks with the American administration about that realignment and a refocusing on Afghanistan and perhaps even Pakistan.
So, Martin, what are your thoughts about this? Remembering, of course, a fortnight ago, in a TV interview made before heading to the US for his first visit there since becoming Prime Minister, David Cameron said that the British had been the junior partner to the Americans in 1940 in the war against Nazi Germany.
Yes, well, I mean, in a way, that sort of remark's just good for a laugh, really, isn't he? Just got it wrong. The more substantial points, as made by Lee, I would agree with. We've got to understand the Kashmir issue is very important to the Pakistanis, as is having a pliable government in Afghanistan.
Well, can you just explain what is going on in Kashmir?
Well, in Kashmir, in 1948, it's a majority Muslim state, but the Hindu Maharaja of Kashmir, I think it was Maharaja, decided that he was going to go in with India rather than with Pakistan. And in theory, there was going to be some referendum about this, which would settle the matter. But it's never really taken place, and it's quite clear that the majority of Muslim residents of Kashmir don't actually want to be part of India, and there have been various violent and non-violent protests about being incorporated into India. And you could actually compare Kashmir with Kosovo, for example, which we mentioned earlier, where the West was prepared to have an 80-day bombing campaign in which thousands of people were killed to force the Serbs to let go and disgorge Kosovo. Meanwhile, Kashmir remains a sore on the Indian body politic. So, I mean, I would agree with Lee, and also what David Miliband said this week. I'm not a big fan of David's, but he said, look, you don't go and start shouting your mouth off in this way. It's very, very megaphone diplomacy. As you said, Tony, the relationship between India and Pakistan is very tense, very difficult. The research and analysis wing of the Indian Army and the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence Agency have both engaged in subversion and violence on each other's territory. It's very similar, if you like, to the Yugoslav situation between the Croats and the Serbs. It's hard to say who's the baddies, because okay. They're both baddies.
Okay, Lee, I want your verdict on this. Is this ineptitude, or is he stirring things up here, David?
You know, it's got something of the man who throws the apple core over his shoulder, hitting somebody and creating a big fight that he walks away from, not knowing what he's done. I mean, I think, you know, the bottom line on this is really just diplomatic ineptitude. I think it was a very inopportune moment to talk about that, and certainly to talk about it as a one-way flow of violence.
So, I mean, it seems that maybe this British Aerospace Hawk deal, which he's doing in India, is also part of this. So do you think he's a sort of trying to sweeten the pill so the Indians buy our, you know, and actually it's providing jobs here in Bristol?
I mean, certainly, when I say diplomatic ineptitude, you know, there's always an underpinning reason for making any statement. Okay, I mean, of course, there are, you know, sort of various commercial and political interests underpinning the statement, but there are ways of making statements, of making statements that you can draw you closer to allies without alienating someone else. And so I think, yes, there's certainly something of those deals behind it, but it was just a daft thing to say.
Can I just say, I'm not so sure it was ineptitude, because he'd been to see Obama previously, and I think most of what he said on this tour, at every level, saying that Turkey joined the EU, for example, has been agreed with Obama before he set off. So he's developing the same kind of relationship with Obama and the Americans as Blair had with Bush. And I think that Pakistan is being targeted for destabilisation, as the Pakistani military believe. And of course, nobody mentioned what the Pakistani military are going to say. Well, do you really want us to open the books from the 1980s, when Robert Gates, who was the current US Defence Secretary, was running Operation Cyclone by the CIA, the biggest undercover operation in history, in which it supported the Mujahideen, followed by the Taliban in Afghanistan. A lot of involvement with drugs trading, heroin traffic. I mean, the Pakistanis are annoyed when they get lectured by the Western powers about their supposed failings on the anti-terrorism front, because they know very well that the Western powers have got their fingers very dirty in the same pie.
Yeah, I mean, I said myself that, you know, it's one wonders how much of this is a result of discussions with the US administration because of that realignment that I spoke about. But, of course, I mean, if the books were opened up in Pakistan, it would be a massive crisis diplomatically. I mean, we even forget
criminal
about
investigations.
The coup. Yeah, of course. But even things like the coup that brought Musharraf to power. I mean, that's conveniently got forgotten as soon as he was a useful partner in the war on terror, regardless of the human rights records, of the clampdowns, of the violence that was occurring at the time, and the lack of democracy in Pakistan with that coup. We just let that go.
If you read the English language press in Pakistan, like Dawn and the Daily Jang and so on, which is all absolutely available on the internet these days. Anybody can read it. You get a very different picture. And this is educated people who read in English in Pakistan, a small sliver of the population. But they are perfectly prepared to believe, for example, that the blowing up of the Marriott Hotel a couple of years ago, there were two MPs in that hotel, Benazir Bhutto's party MPs, and they saw scores of US Marines bringing great big trunks into the hotel without going through security. There's a widespread belief in Pakistani circles that this was not actually carried out by Al-Qaeda at all, but was some kind of provocation by the Americans. Sounds silly to say to Middle England, oh, the Americans blow up hotels. I think that the Pakistani middle class who read their newspapers and actually live in Pakistan have got a much better idea of what really goes on than we have. And the idea that the Americans don't go around blowing things up in Pakistan, they would laugh at that.
Also, these Hawk jets, I think it's nearly 60 of them that they've just ordered. Are they going to have some incredibly well-trained, because they're trainers, supposedly. Do you think that they're actually trainers, or are they actually adaptable for other purposes, like, you know, fighters or bombers and that kind of thing? Either of you know about that? Because it seems, you know, 60 trainers, what do they need 60 jet trainers for? If they're not going to actually be, you know, using them as fighter jets or bombers.
As you know, Tony, a lot of the arms industry is boondoggle. You know, we sell them stuff which they don't really need and get paid for it, and then presumably somebody's palm is greased in India and everybody's happy. But whether the things are actually useful at the end of the day, it's a bit like Trident for us. I mean, do we really need it? The answer's no, but we're going to have it anyway, aren't we?
There's also the issue of lock-in, that once you start supplying them with certain types of technology, they get locked into that and dependent upon you. And we've just seen this actually in Venezuela with the refusal of the US to sell spare parts for their air force. And it gives you control over their capacity to employ weapons.
Because I can remember back in the 1990s and 80s in Indonesia, it was exposed that actually these Hawk trainers were being used as fighter bombers to just bomb people in Indonesia.
Well, I mean, if they could use them for internal repression, they probably wouldn't be much use for fighting the Pakistani Air Force's F-16s, for example, but they could easily be used to bomb villages to crush the Maoist insurgency.
Now, David Cameron and Nick Clegg's coalition government is nearly 3 months old. Drive Time's Marina Morris has been out in Bristol City Centre this week to get your impressions of the Lib Dem coalition.
What do you think about the new coalition government?
I think if they don't spend as much time arguing about what they want to get done and actually get things sorted, they may be okay. But I was a little bit concerned originally. I believe some of them might be right. I think there's sort of some things that they probably targeted in the wrong areas initially, but I believe they need to make some spending cuts somewhere, yeah.
But maybe not the kind of things that they're intending to cut, because those kind of things are just going to, like, you know, make people that suffer already suffer even more. So, yeah, I'm kind of jury's out on what I think of the actual coalition government. I think it couldn't get any worse, so maybe let's just suck it and see.
I wasn't too happy about it. The way I voted, I was doing it, I was trying to be a bit strategic, and when the Liberal Democrats went in with the Conservatives, I was a bit annoyed, as I felt that my vote had kind of been wasted, really. So wasn't too happy about it at all.
Yeah, I'm not that impressed so far, but, you know, because you've got to give them a chance, really. I'm a Labour supporter, so so it'd take quite a lot for me to actually change my opinion, pretty much. I think I would probably find fault with whatever happened, so, yeah.
So I think they should have taken more time to reflect.
But you've seen too much difference at the moment. I'll wait and see in a few years, see what's changed, but they seem to be doing the right job.
I suppose I think that they're doing the best job they can at the moment, and it's not an easy time to do it, but, yeah, it could be a good thing for the future. See how a bit of a change in the way that politics works in the country.
Who did you vote for? And would you vote in the same way if there was an election tomorrow?
I usually vote Labour. For once, I decided not to. I voted for Liberal Democrats based on I couldn't support Labour with the war and a few other sort of policies that they'd had over the last few years. But after what the Liberal Democrats did, kind of go into the coalition government with Conservative, I've never, ever vote for Liberal Democrats ever again. That's my one and only vote to them. Yeah.
But I voted Conservative.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Labour. Probably, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've always been with Labour, really.
Yeah, I would vote Labour again, yeah, definitely.
Yes. Because I previously voted Labour, so.
I didn't actually vote myself, no. I didn't get in time to elect because I was in the hospital in the sun, so.
I voted Labour. So, I'm not sure. I haven't really thought about it, to be honest.
Well, that was our Vox Pop this week from Marina Morris in Bristol City Centre, asking you what you think about the LibCon coalition so far. What do you think, Martin? I mean, how's things going along? Because you were saying right at the start, oh, this isn't going to last, and actually it seems like it's a fairly robust coalition.
Well, as I think there's been quite a lot of rowing so far. There's quite a lot of differences between the two parties. I think the most significant thing that's happened is that Standard & Poor's and the other ratings agencies, which are themselves open to criticism, because, of course, they rated all of this junk as AAA, and they've got far too much power.
This is in the investment banking sector.
What you've got is that their job is to rate investments, what you can invest in, what you can't invest in, what's reliable, what's not reliable. Now, in fact, there's a big question mark over whether these people are independent and sufficiently technical in what they're doing, or whether there's a political agenda behind it. But nevertheless, what they've said is that because the coalition is cutting public expenditure, they believe that the economy will probably go down, and therefore that the deficit will increase. And we see in this month, for the first time in several months, that house prices have started to grow down, because that's the effect of the coalition's threat to cut. They haven't even started cutting yet. Now, what's happened is both the Liberal Nick Clegg and David Cameron have come to power on the assumption that they can cut public expenditure. And the problem is that we've got an economic crisis caused by the collapse of the private banks, and the public sector deficit is a symptom of that. It's like having cancer that makes you have diarrhoea, and they're trying to take the diarrhoea rather than the cancer. And of course, they can't, in fact, cut public expenditure, because as they try to do so, what will happen is the economy will go down, and then the deficit will increase. That's what all serious analysts are saying in the City. In Standard & Poor's basically said, we're still putting Britain in the danger zone because you're cutting. Not because you're cutting too much, but because you're cutting. Now, in actual fact, the solutions to these problems do not lie in this conventional field. But these people are basically, the people in charge, Cameron, Clegg, are basically conventional thinkers. And even Vince Cable, who showed some understanding of this, said that last week, we've got to rebalance the economy in favour of the private sector. And that's simply wrong. We're only going to get out of this depression, as we did in the 1930s, by public sector investment. It's the only way, and it'll take a while before the penny drops, but people will realise.
Yeah, I think that the one of the key measures that could have been undertaken is reform of the role of finance capital, of the role of the banks in Britain. But it was interesting to see the way that was any measure of attempt to do something with the banks was reported in on the media during the budget. I remember on the BBC, they had percentage cuts and percentage increases in tax and spending. But when it came to the banks, they gave an absolute figure of $2 billion windfall tax. But of course, that doesn't tell us anything about the proportion of bank income that is actually raised in tax. I mean, it must be 0.0001%. And so they're just not prepared to tackle any of the fundamental structural economic problems that there are, because I think they would expose some sort of fundamental flaws in the economic system.
So, I mean, do you think that the coalition can actually withstand this? We were hearing from one woman voter, Bristol voter there, that she voted Lib Dem this time, but it's the last time she's ever going to do it because of the deal that's been done with the Conservatives.
I think the big losers in the coalition will be the Lib Dems. I think that it was a bit naive of Clegg to say that he would go with the party with the most votes, because of course that was the party that probably people who voted Labour and Lib Dem wanted the least. So it depends how you look at those voting figures, but certainly there are going to be a lot of people who will never vote for them again. But the big question, I think, in terms of the viability in the long term of the coalition are the dark forces who shuffle around corridors making decisions about our democracy. And if, newspaper editors and backbenchers on the right of the Conservative Party are meeting up and expressing concern about the coalition moving too far to the centre, then they may well decide to cause some disruption in the coalition and overthrow it.
Well, we shall see. Lee, you have just not long come back from Venezuela. What were you doing over there in South America?
Yeah, that's right. I'm doing a research project on the representation of Venezuelan politics in the British media, particularly on the BBC. And I was out there over Christmas, travelling around the country and largely talking, strangely enough, to some of the sort of right-wing elements in Venezuela. The government at the moment is very far on the left, and was elected in 1998 with a massive landslide victory, something like 60% of the population has been re-elected every few years ever since, with well over 50%, which we compare to David Cameron's, what?
37%.
It's quite striking. And then this time I went over to visit some of the projects that the government has been implementing over there, particularly in the slum areas, in the barrios or favelas as they're called in Brazil. And we went around to speak to people who, you know, had benefited from some of the reforms, and also to speak to them what life was like before this present government was in power, when, you know, something like 80% of the population was living in poverty. So we've kind of met some of the correspondents for Western media outlets to interview them about how they perceive things and how their subjective position may actually result in some quite biased coverage, which we found is certainly the case when it comes to Venezuela.
Martin, I know you've been having a look at a film about Venezuela, which is coming into the cinemas, I think, this coming weekend. It got rather a slating on BBC Radio 4's Front Row programme. Can you just tell us about that? What's it called, first of all?
I'll have to look in the article what it's called. It's a film by Oliver
Stone. South of the Border.
South of the Border, and Lee probably knows more about it than I do. I mean, as I understand, it's not just about Venezuela. He interviews...
This is Oliver Stone.
Oliver Stone. Yeah. Many people will know him from, I don't know, JFK or... The Doors, or he's a rather critical filmmaker. He's probably one of the most critical in Hollywood. And what he's done is he's done a fairly unambitious film. He's just gone and talked to all of the leaders of the left-wing countries in the Bolivarian bloc in Latin America, of which Venezuela is the acknowledged leader, and Chavez. But you've got Evo Morales in Bolivia, and Rafael Correa in Ecuador, and so on.
I know,
so he interviewed all of those people.
I know Oliver Stone himself has said that he wanted to make a film which readjusted what he saw as a very biased view of Latin America in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, Chavez is openly called a dictator all the time in the Western media, particularly in the US. And as Lee's just pointed out, he's been re-elected, I think it's 11 times now, and every time he's won. That's the great strength of what he's been doing. He's despite the media being against him, he's delivered for the people who he represents, and they have re-elected him, although there was an attempted coup, which perhaps Lee would like to tell us a bit about, that because that generated the film The Revolution Will Not Be Televised.
That's right.
It,
yeah. I mean, that was, you know, astonishing in terms of sort of bad journalism and you know, perhaps even sort of international propaganda campaigns, who knows. Just to give a bit of context, you know, in the 1960s and 1970s, all over South America, there were movements like there were in Europe in the 1920s and 30s to establish basic welfare, education, you know, social services, and so on, through democratic movements. Where these were successful, such as in Chile, Salvador Allende was elected president and was duly overthrown in 1973, September the 11th, funnily enough, with the resulting 4,000, I think, deaths immediately following his overthrow. The coup then was backed by the United States. They introduced what we call a strategy of tension, whereby Secret Service operatives go into various social movements and trade unions and things and try to create turbulence and instability in the country. So the only solution is to get rid of what's perceived as the cause, which is the leader, the elected leader. But then in Nicaragua, in El Salvador, in Honduras, in Argentina, in Brazil, all over South America, these right-wing dictatorships backed by the US emerged with horrific human cost. Hundreds of thousands of people all over South America massacred by various rebel groups, or terrorist groups as they would be called nowadays, such as the US-backed Contras in Nicaragua. So there's a long history of anything democratic or social democratic, any movement that's trying to give a little bit of dignity to the ordinary people of various Latin American countries, particularly when they threaten US interests, economic interests, like fruit, or in the case of Venezuela, oil. They've just been discovered to have the largest reserves of oil, larger than Saudi Arabia, by the US Geological Survey. Anytime this happens, the Americans and the British and the Spanish move in and work to overthrow the government. And in 2002, this occurred in Venezuela, with a long period of destabilisation, of management lockouts and demonstrations and shootings and so on, and a propaganda campaign by the Venezuelan media. You could imagine BBC One, BBC Two, Channel Three, Channel Four and Channel Five broadcasting pretty much all of the time very virulent anti-government messages, including calling for the assassination and the overthrow of the Prime Minister. I think if ITV tried to do that here, they'd lose their licence immediately and the journalist would be arrested. And then the coup occurs, and it was, you know, very clearly a military coup. It was run by the business leaders and working together with military generals and various political leaders on the right as well. And the BBC saw fit to refer to this overthrow of a democratically elected leader as restoring democracy in one of their articles. It was quite shameful. Indeed, The Guardian, The Times, The Telegraph, every single newspaper in this country had the same line, which was this was a democratic move. And of course, they tried to install a dictator. Fortunately, the supporters of the president, the people who had voted for him, who mainly come from the poor barrios up in the hills around Caracas, marched onto the presidential palace and demanded their leader back. And fortunately, some sections of the lower ranking officers in the army, presidential guards and what have you, rallied to the cause, and he was reinstalled and re-elected shortly thereafter.
Right. Well, it's 5:30. It's 6:13. And it's time to take a break from our news review to have our guest Lee Salter's choice of music. Now, Lee, what's the song and why did you choose it?
Well, it's good timing for it, actually. It's called The Third World by a Peruvian-American rapper called Immortal Technique. And it's quite an angry song about Latin America and the conditions that people live under in Latin America. Some of the situations you'll find in places like Nicaragua are so desperately poor they would make you cry, you know, and children being shot on the streets and, you know, beggars, poverty of the most epic proportions. And this is an explanation of that scenario and particularly the role of the U.S.,
Yeah. Immortal Technique and DJ Green London. Third world motherfucker. Yeah. I'm from where the golden diamonds are ripped from the earth. Right next to the slave castles where the water is cursed. From where police brutality's not half as nice. It makes the hood in America look like paradise. Compared to the AIDS infested Caribbean slum. African streets where the passport's an American gun. From where they massacre people and try to keep it quiet. And spend the next 25 years trying to deny it. I'm from where they cut your hands off if you make a fist. And niggas throw coca cause the job market doesn't exist. No. Except slave labor, modern day company store. And peacekeepers don't ever, ever, ever come here no more. From where the bombs that they used to drop on Vietnam still has children born deformed 8 months before they gone. I'm from where they lost the true meaning of the Quran. Cause heroin is not compatible with Islam. And niggas know that but grow that poppy seed anyway. Cause that food rap parachute does not come every day. I'm from where people pray to the gods of their conquerors. And practically every president's a money launderer. From where the only place democracy's acceptable is if America's candidate is electable. And they might even have a black president, but he's useless cause he does not control the economy, stupid. Lock and load your gun where I'm from, the third world, son. To many places, but I'm third world born. Gorillas hit and run where I'm from, the third world, son. You polluted everything and now the third world's gone. The water's poison where I'm from, the third world, son. 700 children died by the end of soul. Revolution to come where I'm from, the third world, son. Constant occupation leaves the third world torn. I'm from where the Catholic Church is some racist shit. They help Europe and America rape this bitch. They pray to white Spanish Jesus, whose face is this? But never talk about the black Pope Galatius. I'm from where Soviet weapons still decide elections. Militaries like the mafia, you pay for protection. Catamite sex clauses with the country sells. And rich white businessmen make the best clientele. I'm from where they too pussy to come film Survivor. And they murder Coca-Cola union organizers. I'm from where the justice system is stopped. Podrido. Fuck government, niggas politic over perico. Rebelde conocido, enterrado vivo. como otro argentino desaparecido. Cause Rico laws don't apply to the CIA, and motherfuckers make sneakers for a quarter a day. I'm from where they overthrow democratic leaders, not for the people but for the Wall Street Journal readers. From where blacks, indigenous peoples and Asians were once slaves of the Caucasians. And it's amazing how they trained them to be racist against themselves in the place they was raised in. You kept us caged in, destroyed our culture and said that you civilized us. Raped our women, and when we were born you despised us. Gentrified us, agent provocateur dividers, and crucified every revolutionary messiah. So I'ma start a global riot that not even your fake anti-communist dictators could keep quiet. Fuck your charity medicine, try to murder me. The immunizations you gave us were full of mercury. So now I see the third world like the rap game soldier. Nationalize the industry and take it over. Lock and load your gun where I'm from, the third world. Son to many places, but I'm third world born. Gorillas hit and run where I'm from, the third world. Son, you polluted everything and now the third world's gone. The water's poison where I'm from, the third world. Son, 700 children died by the end of Saul. Revolution will come where I'm from, the third world. Son, constant occupation leaves the third world torn. Yeah. Concrete jungle.
You're listening to BCFM's Friday Drive Time with Martin Summers, me, Tony Gosling, and our guest this week, Lee Salter, Head of Journalism at University of the West of England. That was Third World by Immortal Technique. And before we go back to our news review, we have a special appeal this week from 50 families in St George who are part of the preschool playgroup at the Baptist Church. They're desperately in need of a new venue to meet in after having their lease unexpectedly terminated last week. So if you think you know of a venue in St George somewhere that you think might be suitable, please do contact St George councillor Ron Stone, or you can email me here at BCFM. That is Tony. The email address is tony@bcfm.org.uk, and I'll forward your message on to Ron. And also, I'll give you Ron's number just before the 6 o'clock news. Now, back to our review of this week's news. We're looking here now at The Guardian yesterday, and this is draconian incapacity benefit tests are failing the sick. Inaccurate, apparently, medical assessments and an inflexible benefit system is putting the most vulnerable at the greatest risk. A disturbing sleight of hand, at least according to The Guardian, within the revised benefit system has been performed on the electorate, and particularly on the sick and disabled. It goes like this. Labour replaced the previous incapacity benefit, IB, with the new employment support allowance in 2008 and introduced a fiendishly hard new medical test, followed by members of the government applauding their success in identifying record numbers of incapacity benefit claimants who are fit for work. Coalition government have foolishly allowed this to continue, and so the new work capability assessment, the WCA, has apparently been successful at weeding undeserving claimants out. Just look at the statistics. So Martin, can we start with you on this one? What are your thoughts about the way that that these new benefit tests are being implemented?
Well, it seems strange to be pushing people who must have some kind of medical issue, otherwise they wouldn't be in the system, to look for work when able-bodied people are being put out of work in large numbers. There's an element of fantasy about this. Lots of people on incapacity benefits, for example, have mental health issues, which are not physically apparent, but employers find it quite difficult to integrate people with such problems into their operations. And basically, you might want to get these people to work as part of their rehabilitation, but the idea that you're going to save money thereby is fantastical. It's actually more expensive to support people into work than it is just to leave them on benefit. And you may have to subsidise, for example, the employers who take them on in order to compensate them for all the bother. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't think about doing things like that as a positive step, but the idea that we're going to save money by clawing back all of this so-called waste and incapacity benefit, it's typical of the lack of imagination of the current government. Don't forget that bankers' bonuses are still going up as the economy goes down. That's where all the money has gone. We bailed out the private banking system, cost billions, and that's far more expensive in the long run than paying out incapacity benefits for people who find it difficult to work.
Naturally, I agree with the economist's outline of this. I mean, it very clearly there are priorities, and it's very clear that the priority has been bailing out people who are already millionaires, billionaires, you know, international corporations and what have you. I think the issue for me with this particular policy is a moral issue. I think that it just indicates very clearly how there seems to be no moral compass anymore. You know, we have an economic crisis that has deep structural reasons, such as overproduction and what have you, which all economic crises are subject to, and some efficient causes, like corruption and fraud on a massive scale in the banking sector and mortgage sector and so on and so forth. We have politicians who, you know, okay, get caught fiddling expenses, almost all of them, but more deeply, you know, go into work after being politicians as consultants. You know, Tony Blair being paid however many million pounds a year by a corporate banking company when he leaves, that's corruption to me, I'm afraid. So the idea that there's this money floating around, that there is these root causes of problems, which are bankers and politicians, and the people who get kicked for it are the ill and the disabled, I think is utterly despicable.
Well, the Citizens Advice Bureau is apparently very scathing about the new test. This year it published a document about the ESA working capability assessment endorsed by major disability groups called It's Not Working. Its three main findings were that seriously ill people are being inappropriately subjected to this test. The assessment does not effectively measure fitness for work. And actually, the application of the assessment is producing inappropriate outcomes. Also, the medicals are being conducted apparently without an impartial independent body present. So ATOS itself, it's carrying out the tests, is monitored and audited by its employer, the Department for Work and Pensions, from which it earns a robust £500 million for a seven-year contract. ATOS employees are well aware of DWP targets, even if these are not explicitly demanded or linked to their remuneration. It sounds to me like almost like a cap on the number of people who are allowed to be ill.
This is the morally problematic part of it. I mean, the article reads... So the new work capability assessment has apparently been successful at weeding out undeserved claimants. Look at the statistics. Only 6% of claimants are now found so ill or disabled they are eligible for full support. The idea that you measure success of welfare on the number of people you exclude from a pittance of money whilst giving however many billions to the banking sector is wrong. And the fact that the politicians and, you know, some newspapers and journalists and opinion leaders have been able to manipulate public debate so you have question time where the questions aren't should we cut or should we invest, but how much should we cut and where, I think is a cause of despair, great despair.
Martin, do you think Lee's right there about the way that these questions are framed sometimes?
Absolutely. I mean, we've all it's been presented to us that we've got to cut, and that's partly, of course, because the Labour leadership in the election campaign also said that they would cut, although I think they're now reconsidering that position. I don't think any of these people have read their economics textbook. You can't downsize your way out of a recession, and we're not going back to neoliberal free market economy. That's not going to happen. The only way we're going to get out of this is as we did in the 30s, by having a very strong government intervention to retool the economy for a green revolution which will put people to work. Now that's actually a whole program which we've not been talking about in the Labour Party, and of course nobody else has been talking about it either, and therefore we're all talking about cuts. But cuts are just economically illiterate, as we're going to find out. We're going to find out that very soon people are going to realise what's wrong with all of this, because the danger here is we get into proper deflation. We haven't been in proper deflation.
Well, what is deflation?
Deflation is the opposite of inflation. It's falling prices, which sounds like a good idea.
It does. It sounds great.
It sounds great, but of course that means falling profits. It means that nobody invests. And of course, deflation, just like inflation, feeds on itself. And there is a real danger that once you get into deflation, as Japan did in 1990, that you never get out of it, ever.
Yeah, but Japan did.
No, they haven't. They're teetering on the brink of it now. And, of course, they got out of it because the rest of the world wasn't in deflation and they're the only people who were. Now everybody's going to be in deflation. Now, this is really scary. This is far bigger and more dangerous than the 30s. And the people in charge don't even seem to understand what the problem is. They're just doing what they did yesterday and thinking that's going to be good enough. It won't be.
But moving this benefit story a little bit closer to home, we hear that the council, Bristol City Council's benefit service, has just got a zero from a government watchdog. It's been condemned as poor in a report by the Audit Commission yesterday. The Commission, which is an independent watchdog, has given the service a zero-star rating and says it has uncertain prospects for improvement. The Bristol City Council's benefit service acts as an agency for the government, paying out more than £200 million a year to more than 62,000 benefit claimants in the city. A low score has been given because people wait too long for claims to be processed here in Bristol. Some people find letters they receive about their benefits claim very hard to understand. Phone callers with benefit queries can wait a very long time before they speak to an advisor, and the problem is getting worse. People have to wait too long for a review of their case. And finally, more consistent action to reduce the fraud would help cut costs and save taxpayers' money. Bristol City Council responded by saying it's drawn up an action plan of improvements, some of which have been introduced. But Philip Souter, Audit Commission senior manager, said successfully claiming benefits is an essential safety net for many people, especially during the current economic downturn. Lee, what are your thoughts about this report by the Audit Commission?
Well, it's another disturbing story about Bristol Council. You know, it's schools, buses, transport, and now benefits. Clearly, then, you know, needs to be something done.
Do you think there's actually an element here, though, of actually blaming the council for something which is actually just part of a recession where there's more and more demands on services like this?
Well, I think that there's you know, clearly some specific issues with Bristol Council, which is why the Audit Commission has singled them out. But I think that if you want to look at this in a broader term, I mean, I think the rapidity with which the crisis has hit and the depth of the crisis is, of course, going to overload social services. I think that whilst you're implementing on one hand this idea of savings based around cutting services for the most vulnerable in society, the knock-on effects of that on social service will be astronomical with things like, you know, alcohol and drugs services and what have you for people who, you know, are unemployed in areas where there is no reinvestment whatsoever. I think that, of course, that's going to cause a slowdown. And yes, on that respect, it's an issue for central government to address, but frankly, I've got no hope that they will.
Next story, Conrad Black is back. Disgraced press baron has been freed from a US prison after posting $2 million in bail. Disgraced former press baron Conrad Black has been freed. Is it Lord Black, I believe? Has been freed from prison this afternoon. That was actually the 21st of July, so it's just over a week ago. After posting $2 million in bail, Judge Amy St. Eve of the US District Court in Chicago has set Black, who is 65, free while she considers whether to throw out his 2007 conviction for a multi-million pound fraud. Now, Lee, as someone that's studying journalism, now, Conrad Black, I don't know how many newspapers he used to own. He had the Daily Telegraph, the Jerusalem Post, and I think something like 80 or 90 more newspapers. Now, do you think actually he's done his time now? And this is actually quite a good thing and a bit of compassion that they've let Conrad Black, the great press baron, out of prison?
I'm going to have to take off my professional hat for a moment. I mean, you've got prison reform people speaking later, and there's one prisoner I think probably needs to spend a lot more time in prison. I think that, you know, again, it's one of these kind of deep inequities of how the law gets applied. This idea of white-collar crime, you know, if you steal money from pension funds that hundreds, if not thousands, of people rely on, you know, and then you've still got $2 million bail. Where did he get that money from? But the idea that just because you have $2 million, you can get out of prison is again, disgusting. It's a despicable decision to base it on that idea of having the money to post that much bail. Now, if you get someone who maybe steals from a shop five times and burgles a couple of houses, they're not going to get out on bail under these sorts of conditions. you know, the fact that, you know, the good side, the bright side of this is that Comrade Black, who, like Rupert Murdoch, was very, very controlling over his media empire and the line they took, hasn't got that media empire in such substantial size anymore, which is, you know, to be welcomed. Well, it would be if the Barclay brothers hadn't taken over the Daily Telegraph. I don't quite know which is the worst of the two evils.
Martin, I mean, it's quite interesting that people like Conrad Black are referred to as a press baron. Is this a sort of new feudal system, and has he sort of paid a little bit of money to the king to get himself out of jail here?
Well, I mean, the use of the word baron is, you know, comparing them to feudal lords, isn't it? I mean, and there clearly is a very big difference in the way people are treated by the courts. During the savings and loans collapse, scandal and collapse in the 1980s, which was the Reagan-era bubble and burst, thousands of people were sent to prison. What's happened this time is clearly criminal acts, and I'm not talking about Conrad Black here, I'm talking now about Goldman Sachs and other big players in the hedge fund game. Clearly criminal acts have not only been not punished, they've been rewarded. And I think we're going, you know, one of the symptoms of our getting things right is that we'll have to probably create a whole new series of prisons for white-collar prisoners, because there's going to be so many of them, and we can't just bung them in with everybody else, but they must be punished. It's very important, because otherwise we're going to carry on having problems with the financial sector. And that's when people say, oh, well, if you raise taxes on the wealthy, they'll just go off to other countries. I'll say, no, they won't, because they're going to be in Pentonville.
Now, Conrad Black was convicted of obstruction after jurors saw a video of him, and I remember seeing this myself and rather smiling, when he was carrying boxes of documents that were sought by government investigators out of his Toronto office and loading them into his car before driving off. The obstruction charge was not part of this appeal. So, anyway, Conrad Black is out of jail.
Just one last thing on that, actually. It would be nice to see what the Telegraph's line on this is, whether they're saying, you know, the prison system should be tougher on prisoners and take away all of their vices, you know, to make them reform, because otherwise prison's too cushy. I wonder if it was too cushy for Conrad Black as well.
Right, well, we did cover this story briefly last week. This is about the murder of a Greek investigative journalist, Socrates Giolas. And we're here this week, bizarrely, I'm not quite sure how people originally knew that the Sect of Revolutionaries terror group had killed this Greek journalist. And this is particularly important because this guy was exposing corruption at the top of Greek society. We now hear from the Independent and various other papers Wednesday this week that the leftist Greek guerrilla group is in fact called the Rebel Sect, rather than the Sect of Revolutionaries. Maybe it's just something that's been lost in translation. Anyway, Lee, what are your thoughts about the killing of this Socrates Giolas, 37 years old, outside his home on the 19th of July, because he was the news chief of a local radio station there, Thema 98.8 in Greece?
I don't want to cop out of the question, but who knows? I mean, I think what you're seeing in Greece is a very difficult situation with mass protests, you know, disappointingly actually, that haven't spread around the rest of Europe while we're also facing massive cuts and what have you, but a very strong challenge to the Greek political and economic system. And when that occurs, when such near revolutionary situations occur, states act very forcefully. I mean, there were the plans to have a coup in this country in the 1970s should the Labour Party go too left-wing in government. And, you know, as I've already mentioned, all over South America. So, one would be surprised if he had been killed by this terrorist group, but equally one would be surprised if not.
Well, thanks very much to this week's guest, Lee Salter, Head of Journalism at University of the West of England. After the news, we look at prison reform.
It is your voice and it is your choice.
CFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.